One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your host, Peter Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. And once again, I am missing my co-host. It's tough out there. And
no, not you're not.
Oh, well, yeah, but you're not supposed to be my co-host on Fridays, right? Charging.
No, I am. I am your co-host.
Oh, really?
On Fridays.
How come?
Yeah.
Right, because some people have been missing in action for a while. David was missing in action. Then Diane has a hard time making it. But you say that there's another lady that may actually join the show at some point, right?
Yeah, I asked Cindy Milstein, who works for the Institute of Anarchist Studies.
Nice.
She's a very good speaker, and she's written about anarchism a lot and lectured.
Yes, we would be delighted to have her here.
I wrote her an email, and she said she's interested, and we're going to have to talk about details, but
nice.
We'll see how it works out.
You actually went yesterday to record some event, right?
Yeah, I went to MIT. They were sponsoring a talk by Nalalai Joya, who is a parliamentarian from Afghanistan. She was the youngest parliamentarian elected and one of the only women. And I don't know if people are familiar with this event, but early on, after the puppet government was installed,
right.
They had a big, they had a big meeting, and there was a girl, young girl, who was basically there denouncing all the, inclusion of all the warlords that were, in power before and now in power again. And so, they threw her out, and that was her. That was another like Joya. But, she's been a activist for a long time in Afghanistan. During the Russian occupation, and then during the Taliban, and now during the U.S. occupation. And she's been doing a lot of underground work, teaching girls in people's basements, taking in orphans. So she's been really active for a long time, even though she's like my age, she's 31. So recently she just another thing is that she's been under threat of death for a long time. They wanted to get rid of her. So she survived like 5 assassination attempts.
Wow.
So there was bodyguards everywhere. There was a police presence at her talks. But, she's a very brave woman.
Well, I'm sure she is. And, you must be to survive in that environment. And, of course, we all heard about the horrors of the Taliban, but the opposing side, the so-called Northern Alliance, they were not precisely members of the Women's Liberation Movement. They were...
right. And that was one of her main points during her talk, is that, the people that the U.S. are supporting are basically drug lords and warlords from years past, that were oppressing the people just as,
right.
Whatever power center. Yeah. So, one of her, main plea was to, for the U.S. to completely withdraw. And of course, that got some reaction. Some people, they're arguing, the same old argument that, the U.S. have to stay, so if they don't, if they leave right away, then we're going to have a civil war and all that stuff. And her answer to that was, right now, the situation is already very bad.
Right.
And
so,
we have all, we have multiple enemies. So, like, if the U.S. leaves, then we know we have only one enemy to fight.
Right,
with the U.S., go ahead.
I think the problem was with that argument is that it could have been given by the USSR. In fact, they had a pretty strong argument, because they in fact, the USSR actually built roads, schools, hospitals. They did more to build Afghanistan than the United States, right? Now, they could have said, look, if we withdraw from this country, it's going to be a civil war, and they're going to lose all the secular values that we've spread all over the country. They're going to lose all these things that we're constructing in the country, all these schools, all these things. And, there was some truth to it. It's true that after they left, there was a civil war, and it was pretty horrifying. But it was so bad that when the Taliban took over, a lot of people were happy about it, because at least they brought some stability. Because before that, you had rapists and murderers and people killing each other left and right. So it was one form of tyranny for another, but one was even less acceptable. So, but that we don't gather from that the USSR had the right to stay in Afghanistan, because occupiers they don't have any rights; they have responsibilities, and their first responsibility is to heed the will of the victims.
Yeah,
and that's what Chomsky.
Another point that she made, which I thought was really important, is that even though the country is so bad, such a horrible situation, that there is a civil society building. She being part of it, but what happens is that these women who are trying to do things, teach kids, teach girls, academics and whatever, they're being raped and killed and threatened. They have to do it underground. Now, the anti-war movement here, we should be demanding for the U.S. withdrawal, but we should also be supporting the civil society there. And that was her other point, which I thought was very important.
Yeah, but, I feel a little frustrated myself, because even with my own actions, because I, for several years I was very involved in the anti-war movement, and I was, unfortunately I had to work with Answer Coalition and other sort of Leninist organizations, because they were the ones that were organizing the big event. So I was handing out leaflets for them. I was doing stuff, and for a few years I was actually going every weekend with my friend Sam, who died about half a year ago. We were going to Union Square every weekend and protesting the war, handing out leaflets and so on. And I feel, not only with my own actions, but with the sort of anti-war movement as a whole, that it's not doing very much right now. I mean, it's sort of the whole thing is dormant. It's like there's not much going on. And I'm, it's not like the war is over. I mean, the stuff goes on. And there's people getting killed all the time, and there's occupations in several countries. In Pakistan, we've heard about the drones. We've heard about more troops being sent to Afghanistan. We've heard about permanent bases in Iraq and Afghanistan, and all throughout the world. So it's a continuous struggle. But the fact that it's not something that you can just get rid of in a few days or a few years. Frustrates people, I think, and so they don't have that commitment to continue and fighting against the empire, and that's why I think we've seen a decline in the anti-war movement. What's your impression?
Yeah, well, not only there's a decline, that part of the anti-war movement are co-opted. You see that people taking the position of the administration now, like Ko Pink just came out, and that was a big reversal.
Right, they came out in favor of the occupation, right? Because they They see, and that's part of their whole thing. See, if you are part of the mainstream and you're sort of a liberal, you may still do good things. Obviously, you know, you can be an activist from almost any political ideology, but the question is, if you have this faith in people who are in power, and then you take the people who the United States has put in power in Afghanistan as being the legitimate representatives of the Afghan people, then you're going to come out with wrong conclusions, and you know, ideas have consequences. So from what I understand, what happened was that the Code Pink listened to somebody in the government of Afghanistan, and they, the puppet government, of course, and they concluded that, oh no, the Afghan people want us there. But you know, if my from what I know, from polls that were taken a few years back in Iraq as well as in Afghanistan, most people wanted a timetable for a withdrawal. But see, this assumption or this pretense that the United States wants to stay there because of the Afghan people is totally ludicrous, because for years we've had these polls and this data showing that they didn't want us there. They wanted to set a timetable for withdrawal, and we totally ignored it. So it seems to me just sort of a pretense to a veneer to make it seem like we actually care. And unfortunately, the people in Code Pink are falling for that.
I mean, I've never really thought that they were very politically savvy. I mean, they know how to get attention, and they know how to grandstand, and also they know how to fundraise, you know. But outside of that, and yeah.
No, I'm saying that. I mean, absolutely. I mean, in fact, these groups that I've worked with, Code Pink, you know, I've gone out you know, I've worked with the communists, I've worked with the liberals, I've worked with people with whom I don't share, you know, a political ideology, but we work on common issues. But I remember, just I'll give you this little detail, that one of these days that I was protesting with my friend, Code Pink was there. You know, sometimes they would come. So they had this banner that said, it was basically focusing on U.S. soldier deaths, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody, I forget what the banner said, but it was sort of like, they asked me, you didn't want to hold this. And I said, okay, I'll hold it for a while. And somebody came and said, you know, what's the matter? Do you only care about U.S. soldier deaths? And that's the thing, that mm-hmm. It's sort of like, imagine in the Soviet Union, if you had some protesters of the war in Afghanistan, and they said, you know, we don't want our poor soldiers to die, you would say, yeah, okay, it's fine. You don't want your soldiers to die. But what about the Afghan people that the Russian soldiers were killing? Are they not worthy of protest? And in that context, how come Code Pink, after, you know, in most of their banners, in most of their protests, they always focus on U.S. soldiers. They focus on their suffering, on basically a sort of a nationalistic angle. Now their justification for staying there hypocritically becomes, well, the Afghan people want us to be there. So there is a double standard there. There is an inconsistency in their moral fiber, which I think comes out very clearly for anyone who looks at the facts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a high opinion about them, but I don't want to trash them too bad, you know, but yeah. I'll leave that to people.
At least they're doing something. I mean, you have to respect them for that fact. Yeah. At least they're out there, they do something, but yeah, you know, I don't know.
It's the same with the Gaza Freedom March that I was part of the organizing, and Code Pink was one of the sponsoring groups. And they did the same thing, that they were listening to different sectarian groups within Gaza that, you know, wanted to attach a lot of different conditions to the march in order to sponsor it, you know. So they started calling Pinkerton names, and, like, you know, he's whatever, you know. I don't want to get into that, but that's the reason why a lot of people pulled out.
Someone in the chat in the chat room is saying that this sort of death of the anti-war movement, or at least this undermining of the anti-war movement, had a lot to do with the election of Obama. That, you know, now we have a liberal in the White House, so we don't need to worry about it anymore. We don't need to do the same thing if we were doing before when the bad guy Bush was in office. But, you know, as we know, mm-hmm. that doesn't take into account the institutional nature of imperialism, the institutional nature of the occupations. It's not who is at the top, it's who is who controls the whole system.
Right, and you know, you could see this with the people. Like last night in the audience during the Q&A, you know, some lady stood up and she was saying, "Well, if you can, you know, ask Obama one thing, what would you say to him?" You know, and this whole power, you know, worshiping, it's just,
you know, it's interesting you say that, because I got an email on YouTube yesterday, a question from somebody who's, I think they're like a communist or something, but it was a communist who sent me an email and asked me, you know, if you were president, would you try to dissolve the state? Would you try to dissolve states? That is, if I had a lot of power, would I try to dissolve the state? And I said, look, first of all, presidents don't have that power. You know, the power is in the very fabric of the economic system and the state bureaucracy. And even if presidents could dissolve the nation state, they get to where they are by internalizing hierarchical values and by proving them to the people, I mean, to the people they serve. So they most likely would not do that. I mean, it's sort of a logical impossibility. Now, I mean, why would a president eliminate the very structure that gives him power? And even if by some chance he did, he would be replaced along with a state. He would be replaced by a new president, by a new state. And
right.
It's also important to note that hierarchical structures depend on the hierarchical mentality of large portions of the population, not only on the leaders. I mean, the reason why we have a state and we have capitalism and we have these hierarchical structures is not only because of the elites that are on top, but because people have a hierarchical mentality. The state is in our minds, and we have what Marx used to call a false consciousness. Well, actually, it wasn't Marx; it was Engels, but. We basically have a hierarchical mentality, an authoritarian mentality that accepts the elite that rules over us, and which also identifies with them. So, you know, it's really fascinating to study the sort of dynamics of this, because you have a lot of people, working class people, who identify with millionaires, who identify with the elite, who identify with politicians, and that's part of the structure of the state. It's not just the person on top.
Right. Well, maybe we should move on. The book that Malala Joya just wrote, it's called A Woman Among Warlords, and I think it provides a lot of
A Woman Among Warlords. Is it available on the net?
No, it's for sale. I think it's like hardcover, $25. But I can't afford it.
So, anyways, folks,
it does provide some of the details.
Anyways, folks, if you want to call in, the guest call in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So, I guess we're gonna move on. And you were also talking earlier about the fact that Norman Finkelstein, the Jewish American historian who has written books such as The Holocaust Industry and Beyond Chutzpah, and Image of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. Some excellent books that really spell out the history of the conflict in a very meticulous and very honest way, which I think is not very common among certain circles of the Zionist variety. But what you were telling me earlier is that since he had to drop out of this march, this Gaza march that was gonna, that is still going on, but because of sectarian conflict, he decided to drop out of that, and now there's a new project that he's planning, which has to do with the Golston Report. And for those who don't know about the Golston Report, this was a report on the atrocities of both sides. At first, it was interesting because Goldstone's actually he's a pretty staunch Zionist, for what I hear. He works at the University of Jerusalem, and he was assigned to investigate Zionist atrocities or Israeli atrocities, and he said, "I won't do it unless you allow me to investigate the atrocities of the Palestinians," right? So they did, but they found, of course, as usual, overwhelmingly more atrocities on the Israeli side, which is just a reflection of the balance of power and the fact that they are the occupiers of the land of Palestine. It was hard for the Israelis to deny the report because it obviously comes from such a pro-Israel sort of constituency. You know, Goldstone, like I said, he's very pro-Israel. Nevertheless, right after the report was released, we witnessed a torrent of lies. Oh, you know, it's so biased and, you know, it's so anti-Israel, this anti-Semitic, of course, you know, all these things. But it's a very, very solid report. So Finkelstein, if I understand well, is trying to do sort of like a mock trial where he will actually be representing the Israeli side and will deliver the strongest possible arguments for them. Is that what it is?
Well, I mean, that was his first thought. You know, like, it's kind of, it came out on a whim, you know. But now we're a week into the planning, I think we're kind of stepped back from that. I think, you know, the reasoning is that the other side is going to use it to destroy his career, you know. It's still shaping up. It's very early in the planning. Uh-huh. So we'll probably have it in, like a mock trial. We'll have videotaped testimonies from Gaza, and we'll have expert witnesses like, you know, Chomsky, who can give a historical perspective, and we're going to try to get Goldstone himself to testify.
Well,
you know, everything is very preliminary, but it's a very exciting project, actually, because this report, like you were saying before, that Israel is just going crazy because it comes from such a mainstream place. You know, it's not very radical because the human rights groups have been writing the same thing. You know, just right after the Gaza massacre, you know, they're writing, you know, more damning things. But you could dismiss those, you know, as fringe groups. But this comes right out of, like you said, Goldstone is he's a Zionist himself. He's a South African judge, and he's presided over a lot of war crime trials for, I think, Slobodan Milosevic and different people.
Yeah, well,
so very, very credible.
I think it's worth pursuing. And I mean, yeah. I think the Israel-Palestine issue is one in which, I mean, I'm always reporting and talking about many different issues, but this is one that I see a level of fanaticism coming, ideological fanaticism coming from the Zionist side that is really unprecedented. It's just amazing. They have a 24 by 7 propaganda machine to try to, you know, to try to legitimize the actions of the Israeli state.
Right. And also, American Jews are very deep in it. And I think that Congress just passed a resolution to condemn the report, and they're urging Obama to do the same. I don't think he's said anything yet.
Yeah, I mean, and I sort of tend to agree with, I tend to agree with Chomsky when he says that the biggest Israeli lobby in the United States is not AIPAC, it's not any other lobby. The biggest Israeli lobby is the American liberal community. American liberals, the Democrats, are so staunchly pro-Israel. I mean, I remember a few months back that we were talking about that guy who was actually a pretty strong advocate for universal healthcare, you know, that guy, you know, and
Anthony
just,
Weiner from New York.
Right. But on the issue of Israel, I mean, that guy is nuts. He's just totally nuts. These guys are, it's like a you know, faith for them. You know, we got to defend every, they're total commissars when it comes to that. So.
Yeah. So, anyway, if I do get some updates, I'll let you guys know.
Right. Let me answer this call, and then we can go on to break because we're getting close to half an hour. But we have a caller here, so let's see who this is. Hello there. Someone there?
Hello again. This is David from Vancouver.
How's it going, David?
Hi, David.
It's going well. How are you both?
Well, still battling this flu, man. But okay.
I just wanted to give an update about the Olympics in Vancouver, if I could.
Yeah,
sure. Go ahead.
The torch relay got its kickoff today in Victoria, which is on a giant island off the coast of Vancouver, called Vancouver Island, and it's apparently the longest going to be one of the longest torch relays in history, and a bunch of protesters went there to kind of disrupt things and F up, and in fact they are indeed disrupting it. I don't know how significantly. I mean, everybody's joke is get your water guns, etc. But there is something interesting about that type of activism, which is it's playful for those involved, but it's, I think, very threatening to lay people, that people would organize and get together only to do something that's fairly symbolic. I know that the lighting of the Olympic torch is fairly symbolic, but so is protesting it. There's always that question in me, is what is the most effective way to be an activist, or is even the most effective thing to do be an activist? I mean, these activists want to do this. They think it's important to go and protest a ceremonial event.
I think,
but it is just a ceremonial event.
I have to say that the Olympics, even though, of course, it's not a war or anything like that, even though it does have negative effects in terms of gentrification and other consequences of that sort. Like in Beijing, I'm sure you heard about the millions of people that were either removed from their homes or affected by the workings of the Olympics, the whole setup.
I told you something similar is going on here. Yeah.
Right. So I mean,
not to an authoritarian degree, but yeah,
there are things like that. But I think that the opposing the Olympics, sort of like a lot of people look at that, like, man, what could there be about the Olympics that people would oppose? Because it seems like, oh, it's so healthy, and everybody they're like, you know, everybody's healthily competing, and so they have this sort of like ideological prism through which they see the Olympics. So I think when people oppose it, if you can get the point of view across of why you're opposing the Olympics, then people may actually start asking other questions, because it's sort of like it's a neat sort of symbolic event that represents a lot of things that we oppose. So the ideological part of it, I find very, very, you know, worth disseminating.
Also, David, can I say something?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I hear this question, like, you know, what's the best way, and what, you know, I always think that, you know, why not all of it? You know, so it could be part of your activism, but at the same time, you could be concentrating on other things too. You know, building prefigurative projects, you know, anti-war, you know, whatever. So
certainly, no one can stop these people from protesting it. It's certainly something that these people want to do. But a lot of my friends are there right now protesting. I couldn't go, so I just donated money to take buses over there and do so. But I just wonder. A lot of my friends work with a local organization called the Anti-Poverty Committee. And we work in some the poorest neighborhoods in Vancouver, which are extremely poor, like dirt, gutter poor, and that's where they spend their efforts and time. But they're diverting their efforts and time from that to this. Now, this probably gives them a chance to let off some steam against authority, but I don't know how effective that is beyond, you know, a personal self-satisfaction of I told the man to go F off.
Talking about Canada, well, I just heard of an anarchist professor at University of Ottawa. Forget his name, but he's in a legal battle with the university because of his refusal to give the students grades. He gave everyone an A+, and he had this pedagogical methodology that they didn't like very much. So I was just watching it, and I thought it was kind of cool. Did you hear about that?
I did. It's in, like, conservative newspapers. It's really kind of fun. It's like, if everybody's an A, then everybody's an F, basically, is what the newspapers say.
Of course, totally missing the whole argument that he was actually putting forth. I mean, it's sort of like, it's so hard for them to get outside that mentality, you know, it's funny. But I thought he had some very good points that he made, and at least in the video that I made, that I saw.
Yeah, Dennis Rancourt.
That's him.
Yeah, I mean, but universities are not the place to do that, in my opinion. Not that it shouldn't be done in universities, but it shouldn't start in universities. It needs to start in elementary schools. It needs to start in high schools. It needs to start when kids start developing these frameworks of understanding how the world works and how education works and how science works. You know,
right, but
I think that that's definitely more fundamentally more important. Certainly, university it's great and it's kind of funny and it puts a little smile on your face, but it's not going to fundamentally change anyone's perspectives on the planet. They're already far too ingrained.
Right,
you know, they're in University of Ottawa.
And plus, you're targeting people who are fundamentally the sort of the specialists, the coordinator class or whatever you want to call it, if you had a different sort of setup in elementary school, middle school, and so on, high school, that would probably have a stronger effect, because, you know, those are the people who are going to be the working class and the and so on. So I thought that what he was doing was definitely interesting, and you know, maybe it'll have a good outcome. I don't know what's going on with that, but I definitely thought it was.
Oh yeah, it's certainly not worthy. Yeah, it's certainly not worthy of ridicule. It's just from my perspective on education, I'm non high school graduate because it was so oppressive, and yet I myself had a base of people to learn with and learn on and people to learn from. So I got off all right, but if I didn't have that base, who knows where I'd be, you know?
Right. Anyway,
it's sad that the thing that everybody pays for couldn't provide that for me. personally.
Anyway, so it's already 35 minutes into the show, so we're gonna take a break. Thanks for calling, and hopefully we can talk to you later.
No problem.
Yeah. So we're gonna take a break now, and we have another caller on the line, but we'll take him when we come back from break, and we're gonna play "Why Do We Go to War" by Sartan Max. I believe this particular recording was recorded live. So here we go.
Accidents happen that take friends' lives. Disease cuts people down. We improve on safety every message you learn. But there's one thing that we just ignore. Why do we go to war? Why do we go to war? Why do we go to war? Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not kill anymore.
That was "Why Do We Go to War" by Sartan Max. And we had a caller, but I guess we lost him. So are you there, Charnchi?
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Still here.
So yeah, I guess we... I'm going to talk a little bit about... I mentioned the other day that there was a woman that won the Nobel Peace Prize just recently because of... I forget her name, but it was basically refuting the so-called tragedy of the commons, which is sort of a common thing they teach you in schools, that you know, that very often it's used to promote private ownership of the commons, you know, with the assumption that if something is privately owned, people take better care of it because they own it and they have an interest in it. For those who actually believe that, I suggest you go to infoshop.org and check out the anarchist FAQ, because there they spell out all the reasons why that is not true. Like, for example, you know, just because you own something doesn't mean you're not going to sell it off to as a you know, garbage dumpster. You know, you could sell out you know, a piece of land to log it or you know, whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean that because you own it privately, you're going to take care of it. And secondly, I think it's pretty obvious that if we look at real communal societies, there was no tragedy of the commons. They took excellent care of their environment. So this tragedy of the commons is basically a capitalist propaganda. It doesn't exist. There is no tragedy of the commons. There is something akin to that in societies which are not truly communal, in societies that have a capitalist ethos, and so people have been conditioned to be selfish, and so they trash certain parts that are public. But generally speaking, like I said, communal societies have had an excellent record as far as the environment goes. Very often what's pointed out is, look, the Soviet Union had a terrible environmental record. I mean, in fact, just one of their nuclear bombs. The Tsar Bomba, I don't know if you guys heard about it, is the biggest nuclear bomb that was ever exploded. You know, that thing was terribly contaminating. Their industries were terribly contaminating. But these are not examples of tragedy of the commons. This is an example of tragedy of the state elite. Okay, this was not a society that was controlled by the workers. This is not a society that was where you had a workers control the means of production. You had an elite state control the means of production. So we have to not fall for these semantic tricks where you have a word that means something else, and then we apply it to something that means what the original word meant, and so we get confused with the with the meanings of words. And it's actually a good lecture by Chomsky where he talks about this, and it's actually in my channel. If you look for Chomsky, you type the word Chomsky in journalists in my channel, you'll find a lecture where he talks about the utility of interpretations. And the utility of interpretations has to do with the ways in which we interpret words, so that they apply in a manner. We have flexibility with the use of words, and they apply in a manner that will satisfy the needs and the interests and the perceptions of the people who are in control of our society. So, with that said, we have another caller, which I believe is part of the plankton. So. Hello?
Hello?
Pardon, hello? Plankton?
Yeah, that that's you? Me. Yeah.
How's it going, man? Thanks for calling.
Good, how are you?
Well, I'm still battling a cold, but yeah, how's your week going so far?
Pretty good. Busy. But I'm indoctrinating some students right now in anthropology class, so.
You're indoctrinating them. Are you a student or are you a teacher? What are you?
I'm a TA. I'm doing my PhD, actually. And, so I'm an academic. And I actually am working with a lot of the same stuff as Eleanor Ostrom, who you are talking about right now.
Right. You know,
a lot of my research is based on her research as well.
So what's what was your master's on? What was your degree?
Well, actually, my background is in ecology.
Okay.
But the PhD that I'm working on now is kind of trying to get an understanding of common pool resources, as you were talking about, and the connections to public goods and how people can organize around public goods and resources.
If I remember well, this particular book, it's actually a little bit older. I think it was written in the early 90s, if not in 1990 or something like that. It talks about five factors or something like that, four or five, six factors that under which the commons can be collectively owned and successfully maintained.
Yeah. And the design principles.
Right, and the things that actually enter into having commons that are not properly taken care of, and so I think it's a valuable tool to understand how we can successfully collectively achieve sustainability.
Oh, definitely, it's a very good approach. Though I must say that there are some problems that have happened because of it, and a lot of the more radical geographers have picked up on it and have been critical because they actually now call it the Ostrom problem, because she has these eight principles, right? Clearly defined boundaries, proportional equivalence between benefits and costs, collective choice, monitoring, sanctioning, conflict resolution, and the rights to organize, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these plus this idea of nested enterprise or polycentricity, these ideas have been actually taken up by the World Bank, except in Ostrom's work, she always emphasizes the fact that these ideas are not to be taken as a blueprint, right? You can't just take this you know, these eight principles and apply them everywhere and say, okay, if we do this exactly as said, it's going to work, right? Especially the first one, the idea of having boundaries, is taken by the World Bank as meaning private property.
Right.
So the World Bank has taken up these ideas and tried to apply it as a blueprint to other countries, and it's still having negative effects. But that's completely out of the, not consistent with her ideas of it.
Do you think that the model takes into account the, or it's that it is created in order to explain managing the commons within our current capitalist paradigm? Do you think that's what the book is focuses on?
Well, I would say that it's not. It's just trying to sort of ignore that, and saying, given, you know, well, yeah, as because a lot of my research is looking at how these, you know, the book in the book, there's a number of different societies that she writes about. And I'm actually looking at those societies now and saying, okay, what's changed, right? And in case after case, we see, you know, more infiltration of market systems and, you know, price and supply and demand type things. And we also see that there's increasing changes in ownership. So the people that used to own their own gear to fish and things like that can no longer afford that, and there are other companies that would own it and would hire them to take the gear out and stuff like that. So currently we're trying to understand it in terms of this changes in globalization as the, you know, economy becomes more connected to the market, how this affects things. In her original book, most of it is about, so some of these societies were connected to markets, like, you know, Nova Scotia and Canada and a bunch of other ones, but most of it is looking at how the state gets involved and how the state often does not recognize these informal forms of arrangement that people have to manage a resource. So she's not necessarily focusing on, with like thinking about it within a capitalist framework, but she's kind of taking it as this is where we are, and this is what we can do, right? The simple fact is that we are in, like, deeply embedded in a global market.
Right, so, which I think is the right way to look at it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so like, you know, I interviewed a few months back. I interviewed Steve Keen, who's an economist, an economist in University of Australia, and he, you know, we were talking about, you know, like he was talking about how, like, the labor theory of value was slightly flawed because raw materials and commodities also have value, you know, like a machine, for example. Increases the value of the labor of the workers, and so you know, certain raw materials certainly with an equal amount of effort may yield less or more value, but obviously all of that I thought was within the context of our society, of our capitalist society, in which we attribute a certain value and we attribute certain you know, certain behaviors, and we attribute certain ways of behaving to the people around us. So given that sort of attribution of qualities to you know, to people in that society, we come up with social theories, with economic theories. But you know, it once, you know, if say our current paradigm was overcome, then we would need to apply different calculations, different standards, and you know, that's sort of self-evident, I think, but a lot of people still feel that, you know, especially in the realm of economics, that certain laws are sort of certain so-called economic laws are really universal laws that apply no matter what. That, you know, I mean, they even call market systems natural systems. They think that this is somehow a natural outcome of human nature, that you should have markets, you should have some of these structures. So do you encounter some of this sort of dogmatic belief in the field?
I do. I have a very interesting mix of people that I research with, and like my committee is composed of a Marxist, an economist, and an engineer, and so there's a large mix of different kinds of ideas coming up, but some are focusing on certain types of market ways to, you know, reach some kind of sustainability or social justice, but I myself am free to kind of navigate through those lines. There's some interesting things in this research that also, in Ostrom's research, that also kind of blurs those lines. And even the economists and the people that believe in market values still can't, you know, still would recognize these types of things. For example, there's been a lot of studies of different societies and how they would cooperate or would compete against each other in certain situations. So they do these kinds of little tests on people in different societies. And they found that overwhelmingly, people have notions of fairness and notions of cooperation. And even in a market society where people are supposed to be rationally self-interested, more people than you would expect by a self-interested model are actually cooperative. And so the kind of idea is that there's no true human nature. There's just, you know, some people are cooperative and other regarding, and some people are selfish.
I may add that there's some some essays by David Graeber, the anarchist anthropologist, who talks about how, you know, we see small examples of communism, if I may use the word, in everyday life. That, you know, we, even though we live in a capitalist system, that we see these little examples of, you know, you're walking down the street, you drop something, somebody helps you pick it up, and we, you know, people helping each other in small ways and acting in ways contrary to the market self-interested model, and I think that's significant. I don't think we should dismiss that as some people seem to do. You know, because we could certainly institutionalize those tendencies that we see in everyday life, and I think that's part of the purpose that a lot of radicals have, as far as, you know, in a part of the sort of the intellectual backing that they try to put forth, saying, look, humans can and do under many circumstances help each other, engage in mutual aid, even though it goes against your model of rational self-interest. And in that regard, there was a book that came out in 2006. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's called Moral Minds by Mark Hauser, and it's kind of it's very rudimentary, and it doesn't really tell you very much, but it talks about how we do have a lot of unconscious mechanisms that lead us to decide against, you know, for or against something, you know, basically evaluate something as being right or wrong. And a lot of it is context specific, and doesn't take very much to change your evaluation, you know, from one thing to the other, from right to wrong, and even though the actual context is very similar. So I think that maybe if we understood a little more about our moral nature, maybe we could actually use that to explain more significant phenomena. Have you heard of Mark Hauser's research?
No, I haven't actually. Yeah. Where does he research?
What's that?
Where is he based?
He works at Harvard. He's a primatologist.
Okay.
So yeah, I don't know if much can be got if it's useful for other fields, but I mean, it certainly I think that as far as the law goes, it explains some things that, you know, could be very interdisciplinary, because, you know, if you know, he basically presents scenarios that are very similar, and a lot of them involve sort of utilitarian decisions, like, you know, will you kill five people we'll kill one person to save five people, and so on. And under certain circumstances that are very similar to others, we think it's right to do it, and in other cases we think it's wrong. And what happens is that you have so you ask people, what do you think is right or wrong, and the people have to think to give you an answer. Yet when they actually make the decision, it's very quick, it's right away, and it turns out that these are not only unconscious but inaccessible moral principles, and that when you ask people, why did you make this decision, it turns out that there's always after the fact rationalizations, and there are certain biases, like, for example, you know, hurting you by intention is worse than hurting you by omission. This seems to be a bias toward omission, for example, and so you could, I think that if these models became richer, you could easily apply them to say, and of course the biases in our behavior as far as those moral decisions go, you could apply that to larger structures and try to figure out how we can channel our moral faculty toward desirable outcomes.
Right. I think there's definitely something to that, and The approach that Bostrom is talking about is a sort of economics called institutional economics.
Uh-huh.
And though it's obviously mainstream kind of theory, it has this interesting way of looking at it through the eyes of institutions, in which they describe them as a set of rules that sort of organize a society. And with that, you considering the biophysical environment of those people, the community, and you know, what types of attributes people have in that community, and also considering the rules that they already have in use, either formally or informally. These all act upon a certain within a social space in which people make decisions and manage things or harvest resources or create public goods. And this, you know, so you have these interactions leading to certain types of outcomes. So it becomes important to understand the attributes of the people, the biophysical environment, and the rules. And so the rules become a very important way of altering the way that we interact and the outcomes that we can achieve. So I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, by looking at rules, like not rules from a state or anything like that, but rules that we ourselves can create and
90 seconds
agree upon.
Yeah, it's this, you know, it's funny because this self-management sort of paradigm keeps coming back, and it has, you know, it really... It's amazing how it comes. It sort of spreads throughout all these different disciplines of knowledge, and it seems to really work. You know, it has a lot of positive values. So,
yeah.
Well, thanks for calling, man, and hopefully you can call again. It was very good to hear your
60
perspectives.
60 seconds.
So how long before you finish your thesis?
Oh, it's going to be another 3 or 4 years.
So, yeah, I mean,
I
know.
I mean, it's for the long run.
Yeah, those things can drag for a long time, right?
yeah, I'm stuck in Arizona.
Well, man, thanks for calling.
Yeah.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.
All right, bye.
So that was it for the evening. Thanks for listening, and I guess we didn't upload any new songs. So we're gonna play. Which song do you want to play to? And Charnchi, which one is your favorite here?
You pick.
I pick. Okay, let me see what we got here. Let's play Oaxaca song. You know where Oaxaca is? Oaxaca is in Mexico. All right.
10 seconds.
All right. See you guys next week.
There it is. See you later. I'm gonna go back to the